Not if Aki makes him tell the entire story before supper with the captain. Denny envied Aki and Toshio their fellowship, as constant and intense as any star. She watched the boy laughing as he fended off his friend until they disappeared into the tube. "Well, sister," Emerson Dianeti grinned at Denny, "it appears you have a science command. My congratulations."
"Nothing's decided yet," she answered.
"Besides, Kipiru will be in charge."
"Kipiru will have military command. That part confuses me a bit. I don't know where Krydike's aiming, assigning Kipiru after the way I hear he behaved out there. My guess is it's his way of getting the poor dolly out of his high hide."
Denny had to agree, though she thought it a bit cruel. She suddenly felt a smooth, flat touch on the inner part of her left thigh. She yelped and whirled around with her hand at her throat, then sighed when she saw that it was the neo-dolphin anthropologist, Saud, who had slipped his left pectoral fin to goose her. The Stenos gave her an uneven grin. His rough teeth shone brightly. Denny's heart pounded.
"Shark breath, doggerel rhymer, go make love to an unwashed specimen bottle."
Her voice cracked. Saud reared back, his eyes momentarily white-rimmed in surprise. Apparently he hadn't expected Denny to be so high-strung.
"Oh, Denny," Saud sighed. "I was just trying to thank you for interceding with Krydike. Obviously your charms are more persuasive than any arguments I might raise. Sorry if I startled you."
Denny sniffed at Saud's double-edged apology. Still, her reaction might have been overdrawn. Her pulse slowly settled.
"Oh, never mind. Just don't you sneak up on me like that."
Without even turning around, she could feel Emerson Dianeti grinning behind his hand. Males, she thought. Do they ever grow up?
Denny,
Saud's voice crooned like a string trio.
"There is one small matter we have to discuss if we are going to be going on this expedition to the island together. Will you be churlish and let Krydike choose the science commander on the basis of prejudice? Or will you give me a chance? Maybe we can wrestle for it."
Dianeti started coughing. He turned the other way and cleared his throat. Denny blushed.
"We'll let the captain decide what's best. Besides, I'm not sure both of us should go. Charlie told me his analysis of the planetary crust samples may be of interest to you. There are traces of paleotechnology in recent layers. You ought to go see him right away."
Saud's eyes narrowed.
"That is interesting. I thought this planet was fallow far longer than would allow paleotech remnants."
But he dashed Denny's hopes.
"Alas, digging for long toasted garbage of past Kithrupan civilizations cannot be half as important as making contact with pre-sentience and establishing a proper patron claim for you humans. We Finns might have new client cousins before even neo-dogs are finished. Heaven help the poor creatures if the Tandu or Soro or similar ilk collect them. Besides," he soothed, "this is a chance for us to get to know each other better and exchange professional information, of course."
Emerson Dianeti had to cough again.
"I've left the repairs for too long already, kids," he said.
His burr was back in force.
"I think I'll be getting on back to my engines and let you two discuss your plans."
Dianeti's grin was barely suppressed. Denny swore eventual revenge.
Emerson? She hissed.
Yes, lass.
He looked back at her innocently. She glared.
Oh, I'll bet you haven't a drop of Celtic blood in your body.
The dark engineer smiled at her.
Why, bairn, didn't you know? All Scots are engineers, and all engineers are Scots.
He waved and swam off before Denny could think of a reply.
Trapped, she cursed, by a cliché. When Dionidi was out of earshot, Saud sidled close to Denny.
Shall we start planning our expedition?
His blowmouth was near her ear. Denny started. Suddenly she noticed that everyone had gone. Denny's heart beat faster, and her face mask seemed not to provide enough air.
Not here, we won't.
She spun away and began swimming.
Let's go to the wardroom. There are plotting boards and air domes. A man can breathe there.
Thout kept pace, uncomfortably close.
Aw, Denny,
he said, but he didn't press. Instead, he began to sing a low, atonal hybrid melody in a complex and obscure dialect of Trianary. Against her will, Denny found herself drawn into the song. It was strange and eerily beautiful, and it took her several minutes to realize that it was also dirty as hell. Chapter 15 Stenos. Moki, Srikapal, and Hakako Joe spent their latest off-duty period as they had spent every one for weeks, complaining.
He was down in my section again today,
Srikapal griped,
sticking his jaw into everybody's work. Thinks he's so discreet, but he fills the soundscape with his knee-k-k echoes.
Moki nodded. There wasn't any doubt who he was. Crying, crooning, talk-talk rhythms, my group wags tails to his logic. Hakuka Joe winced. Moki seldom spoke Anglic anymore, and his trinary had a little too much primal in it to be decent. But Srikapal obviously thought Moki's point valid.
All the tersiops worship Crydike. They imitate him and try to act like kinetic adepts. Even half of our Stenos seem just as swallowed by his spell.
Well, if he can get us out of here alive, I will forgive even his nosy inspections,
Hakuka Joe suggested. Moki tossed his head.
Alive, alive, to deep, rich waters, follow, follow, a rough-toothed leader.
Will you make quiet?
Hakuka Joe swung about quickly to listen to echoes in the rest area. A few crew fan were gathered by the food machines. They gave no sign of having heard.
Heed your scatter. You're already in trouble without clicking mutiny. I hear Dr. Metz has gone to Takata Gym about you.
Moki smirked defiantly. Srikapal agreed with Moki's unspoken comment.
Metz won't do nothing, Srikapal said. It's common knowledge. Half the Stenos aboard were chosen by him. We're his babies,
Srikapal crooned.
With Orly and Tisht gone, and Hikahi in sickbay, the only one we gotta watch out for is the chief smartass himself.
Hakuka Joe looked about wildly.
You too? Look, will you be quiet? There comes Kafa John.
The other two turned the way he indicated. They saw a huge neofin swim out of a hull lift and head their way. Dolphins half his size got out of the giant's way quickly.
So what? He is one of us,
Srikapal said uncertainly.
He's also a bosun,
Hakuka Joe answered hotly.
He hates tersiops, smartasses too,
Smokey cut in Anglic.
If so, he keeps it to himself. He knows how humans feel about racism.
Smokey looked away. The dark mottled dolphin was like a lot of fins in holding the patron race in a sort of superstitious dread. He countered weakly in trinary. Ask the black men, the brown and yellow men, ask the whales about human racism.
That was long ago, Akukajo snapped, and humans had no patrons to guide them.
Just so,
Srikapal said, but his agreement sounded unsure. They all shut up as Katha John approached. Akukajo felt a recurring chill on contemplating the bosun. Katha John was a giant, surpassing 3 meters in length, with a girth that 2 men couldn't span with their arms. His bottlenose was blunt, and unlike the other so-called stenos aboard, his coloring was not mottled, but deeply countershaded. Rumor had it, Katha John was another of Dr. Metz's special cases. The giant swam up nearby and exhaled a loud spurt of bubbles. His open jaws displayed a fearful array of rough teeth. The others unconsciously adopted a submissive posture, eyes averted, food mouths closed.
"I hear there's been more fighting," Katha John rumbled in deep underwater Anglic. "Fortunately, I was able to bribe Senior Bosun's Thata with a rare sensi tape, and he agreed not to report it to the captain. I'll expect the cost of the tape to be covered by somebody with interest."
Smokey seemed about to speak, but Katha John cut him off.
"No excuses. Your temper is a burden I can do without. Stata would have been right to challenge you for biting him from behind like that."
"Dare him, dare him, Tersiops coward, dare him."
Smokey barely blatted out the beginning before being slammed amidships by a blow from Katha John's mighty flukes. He slewed several meters through the water before coming to rest, whistling in pain. Katha John came close and murmured softly,
"You are Tersiops. That is the name of our entire library-registered species. Tersiops amicus. Friendly bottlenose. Ask Dr. Metz if you don't believe me. Embarrass the rest of us aboard who have stenos grafts in our genes. Vice Captain Takata Jim and myself, for instance. By acting like an animal, and I will show you how to be a friendly bottlenose. I'll use your guts for hawsers."
Smokey trembled and turned away, jaw closed tightly. Katha John swept the cowering fin with a contemptuous spray of sonar, then turned to regard the others. Akukajo and Srikapal looked idly at the bright, decorative Garibaldi and angelfish, which swam unmolested throughout the central bay. Akukajo whistled softly.
"Break is almost over," the bosun snapped. "Back to work, and save your hatred for private time."
Katha John turned about and sped away, the turbulence from his flukes almost toppling the others. Akukajo watched him go, then whistled a long, low sigh.
"That should do it," Katha John thought, as he hurried off to duties in the cargo section.
Smokey, especially, would be quiet for a while. He had better be. If there was anything he and Takata Jim did not need, it was a spate of racist innuendo and suspicion. Nothing would unite the humans in alienation like that sort of thing. And catch the attention of Crydike, too. Takata Jim insists we give the captain one more chance to come up with a plan to get us home alive. All right, then. I can wait. But what if he doesn't? What if he keeps asking for sacrifice from a crew that never volunteered to be heroes? In that case, someone would have to be able to present the crew with an alternative to follow. Takata Jim was still reluctant, but that might not last. If the time did come, they would need human support, and Moki's kind of interracial bullying could wreck the chances of that. Githajohn intended to ride close herd on that Stenos to keep him nice and docile. Even if it was nice, from time to time, to chew the tail of some bloody, shore-hugging, sanctimonious, smart-ass Terciops.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 3. Cassette 3, Side 2.
Chapter 16. Galactics. Rejoice, crooned the fourth brother of the ebony shadows. Rejoice that the fifth moon of the small dusty planet has been conquered. The brothers of the night had fought bitterly for this fulcrum of power, from which they would soon project irresistible might to sweep the skies of heretics and blasphemers. This moon would guarantee that the prize would be theirs, and theirs alone. None of the other moons in the Kestemony system had the one attribute this one possessed, a core of almost 1% unobtainium. Already 30 of the brothers' ships had landed to begin construction of the weapon. The library, as always, had been the key. Many cycles ago, the fourth brother of the Ebony Shadows had come across an obscure reference to a device once used in a war between two races now long extinct. It had taken half his lifespan to hunt down the details, for the library was a labyrinth. But now would come his payment. Rejoice, the cry resounded. It was a paean of triumph meant to be heard, and, indeed, a few other combatants began to notice that something curious was going on, over in the corner of Kasemini's system. While the fiercest battles raged around the strategic gas giant world and Kithrop itself, some enemies had begun sending scouts this way to see what the Brothers of the Night were up to. Let them come and look. Can it matter? A ship of the Sorrow had been watching them for some time. Could it have divined their purpose? Never. The citation was too obscure. Our new weapon has sat unnoticed too long in the dusty archives. They will first understand when this moon begins to vibrate on the 15th probability band, sending out waves of uncertainty that will tear their battle fleets apart. Then their shipboard libraries will undoubtedly remember, but too late. The brother of the Ebony Shadows watched from space as the resonator neared completion, watched as grounded ships fed their combined energies to the resonator. From 1,000 units out, he could feel the wave build. What are they doing? What are the progenitor scorned Sorrow doing? Instruments showed that the Brothers of the Night were not alone on the 15th band. From the Sorrow ship came a small tone, a variation of the beat emanating from the small moon, an echo. The 15th band began to throb. Impossibly, it resonated along with the Sorrow rhythm. The brothers on the ground tried to damp the runaway signal, but it was already too late. The small moon shook and finally crumbled. Great shards of rock tumbled apart, crushing the little ships in their way. How could they have known? How could they? Then the brother of the Ebony Shadows understood. Long ago, when he had begun his search for a new weapon, there had been a helpful librarian, a Pelan. The Pelan had always been there with the useful suggestion, with the helpful reference. The brother had thought nothing of it. Librarians were supposed to be helpful and neutral, whatever their backgrounds. But the pill are clients to the Sorrow. The brother realized. Krat knew all along. He gave the order, sending his remaining forces into hiding. This is only a setback. we shall yet be the ones to capture the Earthlings. Behind the fleeing remnants, the small moon continued to dissolve. Chapter 17. Tom Orley. Honest Suessi lay prone on a heavy work sled next to Thomas Orley. The gaunt, balding artificer gestured at the wreck before them.
"It's a Thenanin ship," the chief engineer said. "It's pretty badly crumpled, but there's no doubt. See? No objectivity anchors, only stasis projectors on the main flanges. The Thenanin are terrified of reality alteration. This ship was never designed to use a probability drive. Definitely Thenanin, or a Thenanin client or ally."
The dolphins circled slowly nearby, taking turns at the air domes underneath the sled, emitting excited sonar clicks as they eyed the gigantic crushed arrowhead below them.
"I think you're right, Hannes," Tom said. "It's a behemoth."
That the ship was still in one piece was amazing. In its Mach 5 meeting with the ocean, it had caromed off at least two subsurface islands, leaving substantial dents in them, and plowed a deep gouge in the ocean floor before finally catching up against a furrow of pelagic mud just before it would have smashed into a sheer scarp. The cliff face looked crumbly and precarious. Another substantial jolt would surely cause a collapse, burying the wreck completely. Orley knew it was the quality of the Thenanin stasis shields that made such a performance possible. Even in dying, a Thenanin ship was reputed to be not worth putting out of its misery. In battle, they were slow, unmaneuverable, and as hard to disable permanently as a cockroach. It was difficult to assess the damage. Down here, the illumination from the surface was blue-tinged and dim. The Fen wouldn't turn on the arc lights they had strung up until Tisht said it was safe. Fortunately, the wreck was in water shallow enough to visit, yet deep enough to shield them from spy eyes overhead. A pink-bellied bottlenose dolphin swam up next to the sled. She worked her food mouth in a thoughtful circular motion.
"It's really amazing, isn't it, Tom?" she asked. "It should be in a jillion pieces."
This deep, there was an odd clarity to the Finn's voice. Bursts of air from her blowmouth and sonar clicks joined in a complex manner to make speech an intricate juggling of bodily functions. To a landlubber human, a neo-dolphin speaking underwater sounded more like an avant-garde orchestra tuning up than someone speaking a derivative of the English language.
"Do you think we can make any use of it?" the dolphin officer asked.
Orley looked again at the ship. There was a good chance that in the confusion of battle, none of those contending over Kithrop had bothered to note where this sparrow had fallen. He already had a few tentative ideas, one or two of which might be bold, unexpected, and idiotic enough to work.
"Let's give it a look," he nodded.
"I suggest we split into three groups. Team One heads for any center of emissions, particularly probability, psi, or neutrino radiation, and disables the source. They should also watch out for survivors, though that seems unlikely."
Suessi snorted as he looked at the pounded wreck. Orley went on. "Team Two concentrates on harvesting. Hannes should lead that one, along with Titscha. They'll look for monopoles and refined metals Streaker can use. Well, with luck, they might find some replacements for those coils we need. With your permission, Tisht, I'll take Team Three. I want to look over the structural integrity of that ship and survey the topography of the surrounding area." Tisht performed a jaw clap of agreement.
"Your logic is good, Tom. That is what we'll do. I'll leave Lucky Ka with the other sled on alert. The rest shall join their teams at once."
Orley grabbed Tisht's dorsal fin as she was about to whistle the command. Oh, we'd better go with breathers all around, hadn't we? Trinary may not be efficient, but I'd rather put off complex conversations in Anglic than have to risk everybody shuttling back and forth for air, and maybe someone getting hurt. Tisht grimaced, but gave the command. The party was composed of disciplined Fen, the pick of Streaker's crew, so the gathering at the sled was occasion merely for low-pitched grousing and indignant bubbles, as each dolphin was fitted with a wraparound hose of air. Tom had heard of prototype breathers that would give a fin a streamlined air supply without hindering the speech mouth. If ever he found the time, he might try to rig some up himself. Speaking trinary posed no real difficulty for him, but he knew from experience that the fin would have problems conveying technical information in anything but Anglic. Old Hannes was already grumbling. He helped pass out the breathers with ill-disguised reluctance. The chief artificer was conversant in trinary, of course, but he found the three-level logic difficult. To cap things off, he was a lousy poet. He obviously didn't look forward to trying to discuss technical matters in whistle rhyme. They had their work cut out for them. Several of the picked petty officers and crew that had accompanied them on the rescue effort had gone back to the ship, escorting Toshio and Hikahi and the other victims of the stranding waves. Only a short score of Fen remained in the party. Should anything dangerous come up, they would have to take care of it. No help from Streaker could arrive in time to do any good. It would have been nice to have Jillian here, Tom mused. Not that inspecting alien cruisers was her area of expertise, but she knew fins and could handle herself if things got sticky. But she had work of her own aboard Streaker, trying to solve the puzzle of a billion-year-old mummy that should never have existed in the first place. And, in an emergency, she was the only other person aboard Streaker, barring possibly Crydike himself, who knew about the Nis machine. Tom smiled as he caught himself rationalizing again. Okay, so there are good and logical reasons why the two of us can't be together. Take it for what it's worth. Do a good job here, and maybe you can get back to her in a few days. There had never been any question from the moment they had met as adolescents that he and she would make a pair. He sometimes wondered if their planners had known in advance, in choosing gametes from selected married couples, that two of the growing zygotes would later fit so perfectly, down to the simple telepathy they sometimes shared. Probably it was a happy accident. Human genetic planning was limited by law and custom. Accident or no, Tom was grateful. In his missions for the Terrigan's Council, he had learned that the universe was dangerous and filled with disillusionment. Too few sophants, even those equipped for it, ever got enough love. As soon as the breathers had been distributed, Tom used the sled speaker to amplify his voice. Now, remember, everybody, though all galactic technologies are based on the library, that collection of wisdom is so huge that almost any type of machine might be inside that hull. Treat everything like it's booby-trapped until you've identified it and rendered it harmless. The first goal of Team One, after silencing the wreck, is to find the main battle computers. There may be a record of the initial stages of the fight above. That information might be invaluable to the captain. And would you all keep an eye out for the library glyph? If you find that symbol anywhere, please note its location and pass word to me. I'd like to see what kind of micro-branch they were carrying. He nodded to Tisht. Is that all right with you, Lieutenant? Streaker's fourth officer clapped jaw and nodded. Orly's politeness was appreciated, but she was likelier to bite off her own tail than overrule any suggestion he made. Streaker was the first large expedition ever commanded and operated by dolphins. It had been clear from the beginning that certain humans were along whose advice bore the patina of patronomy. she called out in trinary.
Team 1 with me to diffract above, listening. Team 2 with Stuessi to taste for treasure. Team 3 with Orly to aid him scheming. Drop nothing of earth here to betray our visit. Clean it up after, if you must shit. Think before acting in tropic clear logic. Now, streakers with stillness, away.
In precise order, three formations peeled off, one group embellishing with a synchronized barrel roll as they passed Orly's sled. In obedience to Tisht's orders, the only sound was the rapid clicking of cetacean sonar. Orly rode the sled until he was within 40 meters of the hulk. Then he patted Hannes on the back and rolled off to the side. What a beautiful find the ship was. Orly used a hot torch spectrograph to get a quick analysis of the metal at the edges of a gaping tear in the vessel's side. When he determined the ratios of various beta decay products, he whistled, causing the Fen nearby to turn and look at him curiously. He had to make assumptions about the original alloy and the rate of exposure to neutrinos since the metal was forged. But reasonable guesses indicated that the ship had been fabricated at least 30 million years ago. Tom shook his head. A fact like that made one realize how far mankind had to go to catch up with the Galactics. We like to think of the races using the library as being in a rut, uncreative and unadaptable, Orly thought. That appeared to be largely true. Very often the galactic races seemed stodgy and unimaginative. But he looked at the dark, hulking battleship and wondered. Legend had it that the progenitors had called for a perpetual search for knowledge before they departed for parts unknown, eons ago. But in practice, most species looked to the library and only the library for knowledge. Its store grew only slowly. What was the point of researching what must have been discovered 1,000 times over by those who came before? It was simple, for instance, to choose advanced spaceship designs from library archives and follow them blindly, understanding only a fraction of what was built. Earth had a few such ships, and they were marvels. The Terrigan's Council, which handled relations between the races of Earth and the galactic community, once almost succumbed to that tempting logic. Many humans urged co-opting of galactic models that older races had themselves co-opted from ancient designs. They cited the example of Japan, which in the 19th century had faced a similar problem: how to survive amongst nations immeasurably more powerful than itself. Meiji Japan had concentrated all its energy on learning to imitate its neighbors, and succeeded in becoming just like them in the end. The majority of the Terrigan's Council, including nearly all of the cetacean members, disagreed. They considered the library a honeypot, tempting and possibly nourishing, but also a terrible trap. They feared the Golden Age syndrome, the temptation to look backward, to find wisdom in the oldest, dustiest texts, instead of the latest journal. Except for a few races, such as the Kantan and Timbrimi, the galactic community as a whole seemed stuck in that kind of mentality. The library was their first and last recourse for every problem. The fact that the ancient records almost always contained something useful didn't make that approach any less repugnant to many of the wolflings of Earth, including Tom, Jillian, and their mentor, old Jacob Demois. Coming out of a tradition of bootstrap technology, Earth's leaders decided there were things to be gained from innovation, even this late in galactic history. At least, it felt better to believe that. To a wolfling race, pride was an important thing. Orphans often have little else. But here was evidence of the power of the Golden Age approach. Everything about this ship spoke silkily of refinement. Even in wreckage, it was beautifully simple in its construction, while indulgent and ornate in its embellishments. The eye saw no welds. Bracings and struts were always integral to some other purpose. Here one supported the stasis flange, while apparently also serving as a baffled radiator for excess probability. Orley thought he detected other overlaps, subtleties that could only have come with eons of slow improvement on an ancient design. He was struck by a decadence in the pattern, an ostentation that he found arrogant and bizarre beyond mere alienness. One of Tom's main assignments aboard Streaker had been evaluation of alien devices, particularly of the military variety. This wasn't the best the Galactics had, yet it made him feel like an ancient New Guinea headhunter, proud of his new muzzle-loading musket, but painfully aware of the fact of machine guns. He looked up. His team was gathering. He chinned his hydrophone switch. Everybody about done? All right, then. Sub-Team 2, head off and see if that canyon goes all the way through the ridge. It had cut 20 clicks off the route back to Streaker. He heard a whistle of assent from Karacha Jeff, leader of Sub-Team 2. Good. That fin was reliable. Be careful, he added as they swam off. Then he motioned for the others to follow him into the wreck through the seared, curled rent in its hull. They entered darkened corridors of eerily familiar design. Everywhere were signs of the commonality of galactic culture, superimposed with the idiosyncrasies of a peculiar alien race. The lighting panels were identical to those on ships of 100 species, but spaces in between were garishly decorated with Thenanin hieroglyphs. Orley identically examined it all. But always he looked for one thing, a symbol that could be found everywhere in the 5 linked galaxies, a rayed spiral. They'll tell me when they find it, he reminded himself. The Finns know I'm interested. I do hope, though, they don't suspect just how badly I want to see that glyph. Chapter 18 Jillian.
Oh, why should I, huh? You aren't being very cooperative with me. All I want is to talk to Brukita for just a minute. It's not as if I was asking a lot.
Jillian Baskin felt tired and irritable. The holo image of the chimpanzee paleontologist Charles Dart glared out at her. It would be easy to become scathing and force Charlie to retreat. But then he would probably complain to Ignacio Metz, and Metz would lecture her about bullying people just because they are clients. Crap. Jillian wouldn't take from a human being what she had put up with from this self-important little neo-chimp. She brushed aside a strand of dark blonde hair that had fallen over her eyes.
Charlie, for the last time, Brukita is sleeping. He has received your message and will call you when McAnee says he's had enough rest. In the meantime, all I want from you is a listing of isotope abundances for the transferic elements here on Kithrop. We've just finished more than 4 hours surgery on Satima, and we need that data to design a chelating sequence for her. I want to get every microgram of heavy metal out of her body as soon as possible. Now, if that's too much to ask, if you're too overworked studying little geological puzzles, I'll just call the captain or Takata Jim and ask them to assign somebody to go down and help you.
The chimp scientist grimaced. His lips curled back to display an array of large yellowed buck teeth. At the moment, in spite of the enlarged globe of his cranium, his outthrust jaw, and his opposable thumbs, he looked more like an angry ape than a sapient scientist.
Oh, all right.
His hands fluttered, and emotion made him stammer.
But this is important. Understand? I think Kithrop was inhabited by technological sophons as recently as 30,000 years ago. Yet the Galactic Migration Institutes had this planet posted as fallow and untouchable for the last 100 million.
Jillian suppressed an urge to say, "So what?" There had been more defunct and forgotten species in the history of the 5 galaxies than even the library could count. Charlie must have read her expression.
"It's illegal!"
he shouted. His coarse voice cracked.
"If it's true, the Institute of Migration should be told. They might even be grateful enough to help get those crazy religious nuts overhead to let us alone."
Jillian lifted an eyebrow in surprise. What was this? Charles Dart pondering implications beyond his own work? Even he, then, must think from time to time about survival. His argument about the laws of migration were naive, considering how often the codes were twisted and perverted by the more powerful clans. But he deserved some credit.
"Okay, that's a good point, Charlie," he said. "I'm having dinner with the captain later. I'll mention it to him then. I'll also ask McKinney if she'll let Brukita out a little early. Good enough?"
Charlie looked at her with suspicion. Then, unable to maintain so subtle and intermediate an expression for long, he let a broad grin spread.
"Good enough," he rumbled. "And you'll have that fax in hand within 4 minutes. I leave you in good health."
"Health,"
Jillian replied softly, as the holo faded. She spent a long moment staring at the blank comm screen. With her elbows on the desk, her face settled down upon the palms of her hands.
"Ifni, I should have been able to handle an angry Chim better than that. What's the matter with me?"
Jillian gently rubbed her eyes.
"Well, I've been up for 26 hours, for one thing."
A long and unproductive argument about semantics with Tom's damned sarcastic NIS machine hadn't helped at all, when all she had wanted from the thing was its assistance, a few obscure library references. It knew she needed help to crack the mystery of Herbie, the ancient cadaver that lay under glass in her private lab. But it kept changing the subject, asking her opinion on various irrelevant issues, such as human sexual mores. By the time the session was through, Jillian was ready to disassemble the nasty thing with her bare hands. But Tom would probably disapprove, so she deferred. She had been about to go to bed when the emergency call came from the outlock. Soon she was busy helping McKinney and the autodocs treat survivors of the survey party. Worry about Hikahi and Satima drove all thought of sleep from her mind until that was done. Now that they seemed to be out of danger, Jillian could no longer use adrenaline reaction to hold off that empty feeling that seeped in around the edges of a very rough day. "It's not a time to enjoy being alone," she thought. She lifted her head and looked at her reflection in the blank comm screen. Her eyes were reddened, from overwork, certainly, but also worry. Jillian knew well enough how to cope, but coping was a sterile solution. Instinct demanded warmth, someone to hold and satisfy that physical longing. She wondered if Tom felt the same way at this moment. Oh, of course he did. With the crude telepathic link they shared, Jillian felt she knew him well. They were of a type, the two of them. Only sometimes it seemed to Jillian the planners had been more successful with him than with her. While everyone seemed to think of her as superbly competent, they were all a bit in awe of Thomas Orley. And at times like the present, when eidetic recall seemed more a curse than a blessing, Jillian wondered if she really was as neurosis-free as the manufacturer's warranty promised. The fax on her desk extruded a hard copy message. It was the isotope distribution profile promised by Charlie. A minute ahead of schedule, she noted. Jillian scanned the columns. Good. There was little variation from the millennia-old library report on Kithrop. Not that she expected any, but one always checked. A brief appendix at the bottom warned that these profiles were only valid in the surface crust and upper asthenosphere regions, and were invalid any more than 2 kilometers below the surface. Jillian smiled. Someday Charlie's compulsiveness might save them all. She stepped from her office onto a parapet above a large open chamber. Water filled the central part of the room up to 2 meters below the parapet. Bulky machines stuck out above. The upper half of the chamber, including Jillian's office, was inaccessible to dolphins, unless they came riding a walker or spider. Jillian didn't bother with the folded face mask at her belt. She looked below, then dove, plunging between 2 rows of dark autodocks. The large oblong glassite containers were silent and empty. All the waterways of sickbay were shallow to allow open breathing and dry surgery. She swam with long, strong strokes, gripped the corner of one machine to make a turn, and passed through a strip door into the trauma unit. She surfaced, open-mouthed for air, bobbed for a moment, then swam over to a wall of thick leaded glass. 2 bandaged dolphins floated in a heavily shielded gravity tank. One occupant, connected to a maze of tubing, had the dull-eyed look of heavy sedation. The other whistled cheerfully as Jillian approached.
"I greet you, life cleaner. Your potions scour my veins, but it's this taste of weightlessness which lifts my spacer's heart. Thank you."
"You're welcome, Hikahi."
Jillian treaded water easily, not bothering with the curb and rail near the gravity tank.
"Just don't get too used to the comfort. I'm afraid McKinney and I are going to kick you out soon, as penalty for having such an iron constitution." "As opposed to one of bismuth or cadmium?"
Hikahi spluttered a raspberry-like chuckle. Jillian laughed.
"Indeed. And being healthy will be your tough luck. We'll have you out of here breathing bubbles and standing on your tail for the captain in no time."
Hikahi gave her small neophen a smile.
"You're certain this isn't too risky, turning on this gravity tank? I wouldn't want Satima and me to be responsible for giving the show away."
"Relax, Fem Fin," Jillian shook her head. "We triple-checked. The leak detection buoys aren't picking up a thing. Enjoy it, and don't worry." "Oh, and I hear the captain may be sending a small team back to your island to examine those pre-sentients you found. I figured you'd be interested. It's a sign he's not worried about galactics in the short term. The space battle may last a long time, and we might be able to hide indefinitely."
"An indefinite stay on Kithrop's not my idea of paradise."
Hikahi opened her mouth in a grin of irony.
"If that's meant as cheery news, please warn me when your message is depressing."
Jillian laughed.
"I will. Now you get some sleep. Shall I turn down the light?"
"Yes, please. And Jillian, thanks for the news. I do think it's very important we do something about the Abos. I hope the expedition is a success. Tell Crydike I'll be back on duty before he can open a can of tuna."
"I will. Pleasant dreams, dear."
Jillian touched the dimmer switch, and the lights gradually faded. Hikahi blinked several times, apparently settling into a seaman's nap. Jillian headed for the outer clinic, where McKinney would be dealing with a line of complaining crew fan at sick call. Jillian would show the physician Charlie's isotope profiles, and then go back to her own lab to work for a while longer. Sleep called to her, but she knew it would be a long time coming. In this mood that had come upon her, she felt reluctant. Logic was the blessing and curse of her upbringing. She knew that Tom was where he was supposed to be, out pursuing ways to save them all. He knew it as well. His departure had been hasty and necessary, and there simply hadn't been time to seek her out to say goodbye.
Jillian was aware of all these considerations. She repeated them to herself as she swam, but they only seemed to disconnect the larger from the smaller of her problems, and rob of poignant consolation the unattractiveness of her empty bed. Chapter 19 Crydike. Kanik is a study of relationships, he told his audience. That part comes from our dolphin heritage. Kanik is also a study of strict comparisons. This second part we learned from our human patrons. Kanik is a synthesis of two worldviews, much as we ourselves are. About 30 neo-dolphins floated across from him, bubbles rising slowly from their blow mouths. Intermittent, unconscious sonar clicks, their only sound. Since there were no humans present, Crydike did not have to use the crisp consonants and long vowels of standard Anglic. But transcribed onto paper, his words would have pleased any English grammarian. Consider reflections from the surface of the ocean, where the air meets the water, he suggested to his pupils. What do the reflections tell us? He saw puzzled expressions. Reflections from which side of the water, you wonder? Do I speak of the reflections felt from below the interface, or from above? Moreover, do I mean reflections of sound, or of light? He turned to one of the attentive dolphins. Watasetti, imagine yourself one of our ancestors. Which combination would occur to you? The engine room tech blinked. Sound images, Captain. A pre-sentient dolphin would have thought of sound reflections in the water bouncing against the surface from below. The tech sounded tired, but Watasetti still attended these sessions in a fervent desire for self-improvement. It was for the morale of Fenn like Watasetti that the busy captain made time to continue them. Crydike nodded. Quite right. Now, what would be the first type of reflection thought of by a human?
The image of light from above, the mess chief, Stat, answered promptly.
Most probably, though we all know that even some of the big ears can eventually learn to hear. There was a general scree of laughter at the harmless little put-down of the patron race. Laughter was a measure of crew morale, and he weighed it as he might test the mass of a fuel cell by hefting it between his jaws. Crydike noticed for the first time that Takata Jim and Kathod John had swum up to join the group. Crydike quashed a momentary concern. Takata Jim would have signaled if something had come up. He seemed to be here simply to listen. If this was a sign, the vice-captain was ending his long, unexplained sulk. Crydike was glad. He had kept Takata Jim aboard instead of sending him out to accompany Orly and the rescue party, because he wanted to keep his exec under scrutiny. He had reluctantly begun to think the time might have come to make changes in the chain of command. He waited for the snickering to die down. Consider now, how are a human's thoughts about these reflections from the surface of the water similar to our own? The students assumed expressions of concentration. This would be the next-to-last problem. With so much repair work to oversee, Crydike had been tempted to cancel the sessions altogether, but so many in the crew wanted desperately to learn Kanik. At the beginning of the voyage, almost all the Fenn had participated in the lectures, games, and athletic competitions that helped stave off spaceflight ennui. But since the frightening episode at the shallow cluster, when a dozen crew Fenn had been lost exploring the terrifying derelict fleet, some had begun to detach themselves from the community of the ship, to associate with their own little groups. Some even began exhibiting a strange atavism, increasing difficulty with Anglic, and the sort of concentrated thought needed by a spacer. Crydike had been forced to juggle schedules to find replacements.
He had given Takata Jim the task of finding jobs for the reverted ones. The task seemed to suit the vice-captain. With the aid of Bosun Katha John, he seemed to have found useful work for even the worst stricken. Krydike carefully listened to the swish of flukes, the uncomfortable gurgling of gill lungs, the rhythm of heartbeats. Takata Jim and Katha John floated quietly, apparently attentive, but Krydike sensed in each of them an underlying tension. Krydike shivered. There had come a suddenly vivid mental image of the vice-captain's shrewd, sullen eye and the bosun's great, sharp teeth. He suppressed it, chiding himself for an overactive imagination. There was no logical reason to fear either of those two. We are contemplating reflections from an interface between air and water. He hurriedly resumed his lecture. Both humans and dolphins envision a barrier when they consider such a surface. On the other side is a realm that is only faintly apparent until the barrier is crossed. Yet the modern human, with his tools, does not fear the water side as he once did. The neo-fin, with his tools, can live and work in the air, and look down without discomfort. Consider how your own thoughts stretched out when I asked my original question. The idea of sound reflecting from below came to mind first. Our ancestors would have complacently stopped with that first generalization. But you did not stop there. You did not generalize without considering further alternatives. This is a common hallmark of planning creatures. For us, it is a new thing. The timer on Krydike's harness chimed. He was growing late. Tired as he was, he still had a meeting to attend, and he wanted to stop at the bridge to find out if there had been any word from Orly. How does a cetacean, whose heritage, whose very brain, is built on intuitive thinking, learn to analyze a complex problem, piece by piece? Sometimes the key to an answer is found in the way you formulate the question. I'll leave you all today with an exercise for your idle moments. Try to state the problem of reflections from the surface of water in trinary, in a way that demands not a single answer or a three-level opposition, but a plain listing of the reflections that are possible. He saw several of the Fen frown uncomfortably. The captain smiled reassuringly. I know, it sounds difficult, and I will not ask you to recite today, but just to show you it can be done, accept the echo of this dream. A layer divides sky star, sea star. What comes to us at a narrow angle? The hunt-squeaking, star-catching octopus reflects. The night-calling, star-following tern reflects. The star twinkle in my lover's eye reflects. The sun, soundless, roaring show-off, reflects. Krydike was adequately rewarded by the wide-eyed appreciation of his audience. As he turned to go, he noticed that even Takata Jim was shaking his head slowly, as if considering a thought that had never occurred to him before. After the meeting broke up, Katha John persisted in his argument.
You saw... You heard him, Takata Jim?
I saw and heard, Bosun, and as usual I was impressed. Krydike is a genius. So what is it you wanted to point out to me?
Katha John clapped his jaw, not the most polite gesture to make before a superior officer.
He says nothing about the galactics, nothing about the siege. Nothing at all about plans to get us away from here, or, barring that, to fight. And meanwhile he ignores the growing split amongst the crew.
Takata Jim let out a line of bubbles.
A split you have busily been encouraging, Katha John. No, don't bother protesting innocence. You've been subtle, and I know you've been doing it to build a power base for me. So I look away. But don't be sure Crydike will always be too busy to notice. When he does notice, Githajohn, watch your tail, for I won't have known a thing about your little tricks. Githajohn blew quiet bubbles, not bothering to reply. As for Crydike's plans, we'll see. We'll see if he's willing to listen to Dr. Matz and myself, or if he persists in this dream of carting secrets back to Earth unopened. Takata Jim saw the giant Stenos was about to interrupt. Yes, I know you think we should consider a third option, don't you? You'd like to see us head out and take on all the Galactic single-handed, wouldn't you, Githajohn? The huge dolphin didn't answer, but his eye gleamed back at the vice-captain. Are you my Boswell, my Seton, my Igor, or my Iago? Takata Jim thought silently at the giant mutant. You serve me now, but in the long run, am I using you, or are you using me?
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 3, Star Tide Rising, Cassette 4.
Chapter 20 Galactics. Battle screamed all around the flotilla of tiny Zappish warships.
We have lost the Zaktau and the Zaklenu. That means a third of the Zappish armed might is gone.
The elder Zappish lieutenant sighed.
So, young one, tell me news, not things I already know.
Our Zatini patrons spend their clients like reaction gas and commit their own forces miserly. Notice how they hang back, ready to flee if the battle gets too furious. Yet we they send into danger.
That is ever their way, the other agreed.
But if the Zappish fleet is destroyed here in this futile fray, who will protect our three tiny worlds and enforce our rights?
Is that not what we have patrons for?
The older lieutenant knew he was being ironic. He adjusted the screens to resist a sudden psionic attack, without even changing his tone of voice. His junior did not dignify the reply with a comment. He grumbled instead.
What did these Earthlings ever do to us, anyway? In what way do they threaten our patrons?
A searing blast from a Tandu battlecruiser just missed the left wing of the small Zappish scout. The junior lieutenant sent the ship into a wild, evasive maneuver. The senior lieutenant replied to the question as if nothing at all had happened.
I take it you don't believe the story that the progenitors have returned.
The other only snorted while adjusting his torpedo sights.
Aptly put, I, too, think this is merely part of a program to destroy the Earthlings. The senior patron races see the Terrans as a threat. They are wolflings, and therefore dangerous. They preach revolutionary uplift practices, more dangerous still. They are allies of the Timbrimi, an insult beyond forbearance, and they proselytize, an unforgivable offense.
The scout ship shuddered as the torpedo leapt toward the Tandu destroyer. Their tiny craft accelerated mightily to get away.
Well, I think we should listen to the Earthlings, the junior lieutenant shouted. If all the client races in the galaxy rebelled at once...
It has already happened, the elder interrupted.
Study the library records. 6 times in galactic history, and twice successfully.
No! What happened?
What do you think happened? The clients went on to become patrons of newer species, and treated them just the same as ever.
I do not believe it. I cannot believe it.
The elder lieutenant sighed.
Look it up.
I shall.
But he never did. An undetected improbability mine lay across their path. The tiny scout departed the galaxy in a manner that was picturesque, if ultimately lethal. Chapter 21 Denny and Toshio. Denny checked the charges one more time.
It was dark and crowded in the close passage of the drill tree root. Her helmet's beam cast stark shadows through the thick maze of rootlets. She called upward.
"Are you almost finished, Tosho?"
He was planting his explosives in the upper section, near the surface of the metal mound.
"Yeah, Denny, if you're done, go back down now. I'll join you in a minute."
She couldn't see his flippered feet above her. His voice was distorted in the narrow, water-filled thicket. It was a relief to be allowed to leave. She picked her way downward carefully, fighting back waves of claustrophobia. This was no job Denny would ever have chosen, but it had to be done, and the two dolphins were by nature unqualified. Halfway down, she snagged herself on a strand of creeper. It didn't let go when she tugged. Thrashing only entangled her further, and she vividly recalled Toshio's story of the killer weed. Panic almost closed in, but she forced herself to stop kicking, to take a deep breath, and study the snare. It was just a dead vine wrapped around one leg. The strand parted easily under her knife. She continued her descent more cautiously, and escaped at last into the grotto beneath the metal mound. Kipiru and Saut waited below. Hose-like breathers covered their blow mouths and wrapped around their torsos. The headlights of the two sleds diffracted through thousands of tiny threads that seemed to fill the chamber in a drifting fog. A dim light filtered into the grotto from the cave mouth through which they had entered. Echoes sounding in this rock cage will not be those of happy fishing. Denny looked at Shout, unsure she had understood the poet's fancy trinary.
"Oh, yes. When Toshio sets the fuses, we'd better get outside. The explosion will reverberate in this chamber."
Kipiru nodded in agreement. The expedition's military commander had been mostly silent all the way here from the ship. Denny looked around the underwater cavity. Coral-like, microscopic scavengers had built their castle on the rich silicate rocks of an ocean hillock. The structure had grown slowly, but when the mound finally breached the ocean surface, top life became possible. Among the vegetation which had sprouted was the drill tree. That plant somehow pierced the mound's metal core and penetrated to organically useful layers beneath the island. Minerals were drawn up and deposited above. A cavity grew below, which would eventually accept the metal mound into the crust again. Something struck the ecologist in Denny as odd about this arrangement. The tiny micro-branch library aboard Streaker hadn't mentioned the metal mounds at all, which was also curious. It was hard to believe the drill tree could evolve into its niche in a gradual way, as most species did. But the tree to succeed was an all-or-nothing proposition, requiring great power and perseverance. How did it get that way? Denny wondered. And what happened to the mounds after they fell into the cavities the drill trees prepared for them? She had seen some pits which had swallowed their mounds. Their depths were cloudy and obscure, and apparently far deeper than she would have expected. She shone her beam on the bottom of the mound. The reflections were really quite startling. Denny had expected something ragged and irregular, not a field of bright concave pits on the shining metal underside. She swam to one of the larger depressions, bringing up her camera. Charlie Dart would like pictures and samples from this trip. She knew better than to expect thanks. More likely each tantalizing photo or rock would send him into exasperated sighs over her failure to follow up obvious leads. Deep within one of the pits, something moved, a twisting and slow turning. Denny reoriented her beam and peered closer. It was a root of some sort. She watched several of the tiny drifting threads fly within reach of the hanging tendril to be caught and drawn within. She grabbed at a few for her sample bag.
"Let's go, Denny,"
she heard Toshio call. There was a thrumming sound as a sled moved just beneath her. "Come on! We've only got 5 minutes till they blow."
"Okay, okay," she said. "Give me a minute."
Professional curiosity momentarily overwhelmed other thoughts. Denny could think of no reason why a living thing should burrow into the lightless underside of a mass of almost pure metal. She reached far into the pit and grabbed the twisting tendril root, then braced herself against the bulk of the mound and pulled hard. At first, the springy root was adamant and seemed even to pull back. The possibility that she had trapped herself vividly occurred to Denny. The root tore free suddenly. Denny glimpsed a shiny hard tip as she stuffed the specimen into a sample bag. He flipped and kicked away from the metal surface. Kipiru looked at her reproachfully as she grabbed the sled. He gunned the machine toward the cave entrance and out into the daylight where Toshio and Sayout waited. Moments later, a loud concussion sent booming echoes through the shallows. They waited an hour, then re-entered the grotto. The charges had shattered the drill tree trunk where it pierced the bottom side of the metal mound. The severed shaft canted at an angle below, continuing down into murky depths. Bits of debris still fell from the opening in the mound's bottom. The chamber below the island was thick with swirling shreds of vegetation. They approached the opening cautiously.
"I'd better check it out with a robot first," Toshio said. "There may be unstable chunks left in the shaft."
"I will do this, ladder runner. Robots, heed my close nerve socket."
Toshio nodded.
"Yeah, you're right. You do it, Kipiru."
The pilot, with his direct machine-nerve interface, would be able to control the probe better than Toshio. Of the human support, only Emerson Dianeti and Thomas Orley had such cyborg links. It would be a long time before most humans could deal with the side effects of socket implantation, as well as dolphins, who needed the interface far more and had been bred for it. Under Kipiro's direction, a small probe detached itself from the rear of the sled, jetted off toward the hole, and disappeared within. Toshio had never expected to be sent right back out again with Kipiru to a site where, in his opinion, neither of them had behaved particularly well. The importance of their mission, to serve and protect two important scientists, confused him even further. Why didn't Krydike assign someone else, someone more reliable? Of course, the captain might have ordered all four of them out of the ship to get them out of his way. But that didn't seem to fit either. Toshio decided not to try to pierce Krydike's logic. Inscrutability seemed to be at the heart of it. Perhaps that was what it was to be a captain. Toshio only knew that he and Kipiru were both determined to do a good job on this mission. As a midshipman, he officially outranked Kipiru, but tradition made warrant officers and pilots masters of middies, unless otherwise decided by higher authority. Toshio would be assisting Denny and Sout in their studies. On security matters, Kipiru was in charge. Toshio was still surprised to find that others stopped and listened when he made suggestions. His opinions had been routinely solicited. That alone would take some getting used to. The screen showed a picture sent back by the robot. A hollow cylindrical excavation through the foamy metal. Broken stumps were all that remained of the anchor bearings that had held the drill tree shaft in place. Bits of debris drifted down past the camera as they watched. As the robot rose, the light from above slowly grew brighter through a thin haze of bubbles.
"Think it's wide enough to pass a sled?" Toshio asked.
Kipiru whistled that the passage looked navigable. The robot surfaced into a pool several meters wide. Its camera panned the rim, transmitting images of blue sky and thick green foliage. The high trunk of the drill tree had crashed into the forest. The slope of the pool made it hard to see the damage this had done,
but Toshio was sure it hadn't fallen in the direction of the Abo village. They had worried that blasting away to the interior of the island might panic the hunter-gatherers. They took the risk anyway, because routinely trying to scale the treacherous island walls in open surf would have been dangerous and a foolish exposure to galactic spy satellites. The apparently random falling of a tree on an island would hardly be noted by anyone watching from above.
Uh-oh,
Toshio pointed. Denny moved closer to look at the screen.
What is it, Tosh? Is there a problem?
Kipiru stopped the camera as it was about to finish its scan.
There, Toshio said. That jagged crop of coral is hanging over the pool. It looks about to fall.
Well, can you have the robot wedge something under to prevent it?
I don't know. What do you think, Kipiru?
Some scheme may work if fate buys it. We'll make a gamble and simply try it. Kipiru eyed his twin screens and concentrated. Toshio knew the pilot was listening to a complex pattern of sound images transmitted over his neural link. Under Kipiru's command, the robot moved to the edge of the pool. Its claw arms grabbed the spongy metal of the rim to pull forward. There was a small rain of pebbles as it brought its treads to bear.
Watch out, Toshio called.
The jagged rock tipped forward. The camera showed it tottering ominously. Denny cringed back from the screen. Then the rock toppled over and crashed into the robot. There followed a swirl of spinning images. Denny continued watching the screen, but Toshio and Kipiru shifted their gaze to the bottom of the shaft. Suddenly, a rain of objects fell from the gap, tumbling into the darkness below. The debris sparkled in the sled's beams as it dropped into the abyss. After a long silence, Kipiru spoke.
The probe is down there, lungs unbreathing. I was spared the cutoff false death. It still whistles, stranded echoes.
Kipiru meant that the probe still sent him messages from whatever murky ledge had finally stopped it. Its tiny brain and transmitter hadn't been destroyed, and Kipiru had not suffered the jolt that a sudden cutoff could send to a connected nervous system. But the robot's flotation tanks had been ruined. It was down there for good.
That must be the last obstruction. I shall go then, carefully, testing. Denny, take the sled and watch me.
Before Kipiru or Toshio could stop him, Saug was off his sled and away. He fluked mightily and disappeared into the shaft. Kipiru and Toshio looked at each other, sharing a malign thought about crazy civilians. At least Toshio thought he could have taken a camera with him. But then, if Saug had waited, Toshio would have had a chance to insist on the dubious privilege of scouting the passage. He looked at Denny. She watched the robot probe screen, as if it might deliver some token about what was happening to Saug. She had to be reminded to swim over and take control of the other sled. Toshio had always thought of Denny Sutman as one more adult scientist, friendly but enigmatic. Now he saw that she was not an awful lot more mature than he, and while she had the honor and status of a full professional, she lacked the eclecticism his officer training was giving him. She would never encounter the range of people, things, and situations he would in the course of his career. He looked again to the shaft entrance. Kipiru blew nervous bubbles. They would have to decide soon what to do if Saud did not reappear. Saud was obviously a genetic experiment in which the gene crafters were pushing a set of traits toward a calculated optimum. If judged successful, the traits would be grafted into the main pool of the neo-dolphin species. The process imitated, on a vastly quicker scale, the segregation and mixing that worked in nature. Such experiments sometimes resulted in things not planned, though. Toshio wasn't sure he trusted Saud. The Finn's obscurity wasn't like the inscrutability of Krydike, deep and thoughtful. It grated like the dissembling of some humans he had known. Also, there was the sexual game between Stout and Denny. Not that he was a prude, such hobbies weren't exactly forbidden, but they had been known to cause problems. Apparently, Denny wasn't even aware of the subtle ways she was encouraging Stout. Toshio wondered if he had the nerve to tell her, or if it was any of his business. Another tense minute passed. Then, just as Toshio was about to go himself, Stout shot out of the shaft and swooped toward them. "The way is clear. I'll lead you airward." Kipiru jetted his sled over to the dolphin anthropologist and squawked something pitched so high that Toshio couldn't quite catch it, even with his Calathean sensitivity. Stout's mouth twisted and closed into a reluctant attitude of submission. Still, there was something defiant in his eye. He cast a look at Denny, even as he rolled over to offer one of his ventral fins to Kipiru's mouth. The pilot took a token nip, then turned back to the others. "The way is clear. I do believe him. Now let us go and drop these breathers to talk like Earthmen about our work, and to meet our future pilot brothers." The sled moved under the drill tree shaft, then rose in a cloud of bubbles. The others followed. Chapter 22 Krydike. The briefing had gone on far too long. Krydike regretted ever letting Charles Dart attend via holoscreen. The chimp planetologist would have been less long-winded if he were here in the fizzing oxy water of the Central Bay, wet and wearing a face mask. Dart lounged in his own laboratory, projecting his image, oblivious to the chafing of his listeners. Breathing oxy water in front of a console for 2 hours was highly uncomfortable to a neo-fin.
"Naturally, Captain." The chimp's scratchy baritone throbbed into the water. "When you chose to land us near a major tectonic boundary, I approved wholeheartedly. Nowhere else offered so much data in one spot. Still, I think I've made a convincing case for 6 or 7 more sampling sites distributed about Kithra to verify some of the extremely interesting discoveries we've made here."
Krydike was mildly surprised. Using the first personal plural was the first modest thing Charlie had said. Brukita floated nearby. The metallurgist had been working with Charles Dart, his skills not currently required by the repair team. He had been largely silent for the last hour, letting the chimp pour out tides of tactical jargon. "What's the matter with Brukita? Does he think a captain under siege has nothing better to do?" Hikahi, recently released from sickbay, rolled over on her back, breathing the fizzing oxygenated fluid and keeping one eye to the hologram of the chimpanzee. "She shouldn't do that," Krydike thought. "I'm having enough trouble concentrating as it is." A lengthy, constricting meeting always did this to Krydike. He felt a stirring of blood in and around his penile sheath. What he wanted to do was swim over to Hikahi and bite her softly in numerous places up and down her flanks. Kinky, yes, especially in public. But at least he was honest with himself. "Planetologist Dart," he sighed, "I am trying very hard to understand what you claim to have discovered. The part about various crystalline and isotopic anomalies below the crust of Kithrop, I think I follow. As for the subduction layer..."
"A subduction zone is a boundary of 2 crustal plates, where one slips below its neighbor," Charlie interrupted.
Krydike wished he could let down his dignity to curse. "I know that much planetology, Dr. Dart." He spoke carefully.
and I'm glad our being near one of these plate boundaries is useful to you. But our choice of landing site was based on matters tactical. We want the metals and camouflage offered by the coral mounds. With hostile cruisers overhead, I can't think of permitting expeditions to other parts of the globe. In fact, I must refuse your request for further drilling at this location. The risk is too great. The chimp frowned. His hands began to flutter. Before he found the words, Krydike cut him off. Besides, what does the ship's microbranch say about Kithrop? Doesn't the library contribute anything on these problems you face?
The library, Dart snorted. That pack of lies, that friggin' morass of misinformation.
Charlie's voice dropped to a growl.
It has nothing on the anomalies. It doesn't even mention the metal mounds. The last survey was done over 400 million years ago, when the planet was put on reserve status for the Kerank.
Charlie became so strangled around the extended glottal stop that he started to choke. He went bug-eyed and pounded himself on the chest, coughing. Krydike turned to Brukita. Is this true? Is the library so deficient on this planet?
Yes, Brukita nodded slowly. 400 epochs is a long time. When a world is placed on reserve, it's usually either to let it lie fallow, while new species evolve to a level ripe for uplift, or to provide a quiet place of decline for an ancient race entering senescence. Planets are placed off limits either to become nurseries or old age homes. Both seem to have occurred on Kithrop. We have discovered a ripe, pre-sentient race, which has apparently risen since the last library update. Also, the Kerank, Brukida, too, had trouble with the name, were granted the planet as a peaceful place to die, which they apparently have done. There seem to be no Kerank anymore.
But 400 epochs without a resurvey? It was difficult to imagine.
Yes, a planet is usually relicensed by the Institute of Migration long before that. Still, Kithrop is such a strange world. Few species would choose to live here. Also, good access routes are scarce. This region of space is gravitationally very shallow. It's one reason we came here.
Charles Dart was still catching his breath. He drank from a tall glass of water. During the respite, Krydike lay still, thinking. Despite Brukita's points, would Kithrop really have been left fallow for so long in an overcrowded galaxy where every piece of real estate was desired? The Institute of Migration was the only one of the loose galactic bureaucracies whose power and influence rivaled even that of the Library Institute. By tradition, all patron lines obeyed its codes of ecosphere management. To do otherwise courted galaxy-wide disaster. The potential of lesser species to one day become clients, then patrons in their own time, made for a powerful galaxy-wide ecological conservatism. Most galactics were willing to overlook humanity's pre-contact record. The slaughter of the mammoth, the giant ground sloth, and the manatee were forgiven in light of mankind's orphan status. The real blame was laid on Homo sapiens' supposed patron, the mysterious, undiscovered race that all said must have left humanity's uplift half-finished thousands of years ago. Dolphins knew how close the cetaceans themselves had come to extinction at the hands of human beings, but they never mentioned it outside Earth. For well or ill, their fate was now linked to mankind's. Earth was humanity's until the race moved on or died out. Her 10 colony worlds were licensed for smaller periods, based on complex eco-management plans. The shortest lease was a mere 6,000 years. Then the colonists of At Last had to depart leaving the planet fallow once again. 400 million years, Krydike mulled. That seems an unusually long time with no resurvey.
I agree,
Charlie Dart shouted, now fully recovered.
And what if I told you Kithrop was occupied by a machine civilization as recently as 30,000 years ago, without any entry in the library at all?
Hikaki rolled over closer.
You think these crustal anomalies betray an interloper civilization, Dr. Dart?
Yes,
he cried.
Exactly. You all know many eco-sensitive races will only build major facilities along a planet's plate boundaries. That way, when the planet is later declared fallow, all traces of habitation will be sucked down into the mantle and disappear. And some think that's why there are no signs of previous occupancy on Earth.
Hikaki nodded.
And if some species settled here illegally?
They'd build only at a plate boundary. The library surveys planets at multi-epoch intervals. All evidence of the incursion would be sucked underground by then.
The chimp looked eagerly from the holodisplay. Krydike had trouble taking this very seriously. Charlie made it sound like a whodunit. Only in this case, the culprits were civilizations, the clues, whole cities, and the rug under which the evidence was being swept was a planet's crust. It was the perfect crime. After all, the cop on the corner only swings by every few million years, and is late at that. Krydike realized every metaphor he had just used was a human one. Well, that was to be expected. There were times, such as space warp piloting, when cetacean analogies were more useful. But when thinking about the crazy politics of the galactics, it helped to have watched a lot of old human movie thrillers and read volumes of crazy human history. Now, Brukita and Dart were arguing some technical point, and all Krydike could think of was the taste of the water near Hikaki. He badly wanted to ask her if the flavor meant what he thought it meant. Was it a perfume she had put on, or natural pheromone? With some difficulty, he forced himself back to the subject at hand. Charlie's and Brukita's discovery under normal circumstances would be exciting. But this has no bearing on escape for my ship and crew, nor getting our data back to the Terrigan's Council. Even the mission I sent Kipiru and Toshio on to help appraise the native pre-sentience is more urgent than hunting arcane clues in ancient alien rocks. Excuse me, Captain, I'm sorry I'm late. I've been listening quietly for a while, though. Krydike turned to see Dr. Ignacio Metz drift up alongside. The gangling, gray-haired psychologist treaded water slowly, casually compensating for a small negative buoyancy. A slight pot belly distended the neat fit of his slick brown dry suit. Brukita and Dart argued on, now about rates of heating by radioactives, gravity, and meteoritic impact. Hikaki apparently found it all fascinating.
You're welcome even late, Dr. Metz. I'm glad you could make it.
Krydike was amazed he hadn't heard the man approach. Metz normally made a racket you could hear halfway across the bay. He sometimes radiated a 2 kilohertz hum from his right ear. It was barely detectable now, but at times it was quite annoying. How could a man have worked with fins for so long and never have the problem corrected? Now I'm beginning to sound like Charlie Dart, he chided himself. Don't be peevish, Krydike. He whistled a stanza, which echoed only within his own skull. Those who live all vibrate, all, and aid the world's singing. Captain, I actually came out here for another reason.
but Dart's and Brukita's discovery may bear on what I have to say. Can we talk in private? Krydike became expressionless. He had to get some rest and exercise soon. Overwork was wearing him down, and Streaker could ill afford that. But this human had to be treated carefully. Metz could not command him aboard Streaker or anywhere, but he had power. Power of a particularly potent kind. Krydike knew that his own right of reproduction was guaranteed, no matter how this mission ended. Still, Metz's evaluation would carry weight. Every dolphin aboard behaved as sentiently as possible around him, even the captain. Perhaps that's why I've put off a confrontation, Krydike thought. Soon, though, he would force Dr. Metz to answer some questions regarding certain members of Streaker's crew. Very well, Doctor, he answered. Allow me a moment. Hikahi swam close at a nod from Krydike. She grinned and flicked her pectorals at Metz. Hikahi, please finish up here for me. Don't let them go more than another 10 minutes before summing up. Meet me in an hour in Recreation Pool 3A with your recommendations. She answered as he had addressed her, in rapid, highly inflected underwater Anglic.
Aye, aye, Captain. Will there be anything else?
Damn. Krydike knew Hikahi's sonar showed her everything about his sexual agitation. It was easy to tell with a male. He would have to do an explicit sonic scan of her innards to gain some information about her, and that would not be polite. Things must have been so much simpler in the old times. Well, he would find out her frame of mind in an hour. One of the privileges of captaincy was to order a recreation pool cleared. There had better not be an emergency between now and then. No, nothing else for now, Hikahi. Carry on. She saluted snappily with an arm of her harness. Brukita and Charlie were still arguing as Krydike turned back to Metz. Will it be private enough if we take the long way to the bridge, Doctor? I'd like to check with Takata Jim before going on to other duties. That'll be fine, Captain. What I have to say won't take long. Krydike kept his face impassive. Was Metz smiling at something in particular? Something he had seen or heard? I am still confused by the pattern of volcanoes up and down the 3,000-kilometer zone where these two plates meet, Brukita said. He spoke slowly, partly for Charlie's benefit, and partly because it was hard to argue in oxy water. There never seemed to be enough air. If you look at the survey charts we made from orbit, you see that volcanism is dispersed sparsely elsewhere on the planet. But here, the volcanoes are very frequent and all about the same small size. Charlie shrugged.
I don't see how that relates at all, old man.
But isn't this also the only area where metal mounds are found? Hikahi suggested. I'm no expert, but a spacer learns to be suspicious of twin coincidences.
Charlie opened and closed his mouth as if he were about to speak, then thought better of it. At last he said,
Brukita, you think these coral critters may need some nutrient that only this type of volcano provides?
Possibly. Our exobiology expert is Denny Sudman. She's now at one of the islands investigating the aboriginals.
She must get samples for us.
Charlie rubbed his hands together.
Do you think it'd be too much to ask her to take a side trip to a volcano? Not too far away, of course, after what Krydike just said. Just a little teeny one.
Hikahi let out a short whistling laugh. The fellow had chutzpah. Still, his enthusiasm was infectious, a wonderful distraction from worry. If only she could afford to hide away from the dangerous universe in abstractions, like Charlie Dart did.
And a temperature probe!
Charlie cried.
Surely Denny'd do that much for me, after all I've done for her.
Krydike cruised a wide spiral around the swimming human, stretching his muscles as he arched and twisted. By neural command, he flexed his harnesses, major manipulators, like a human exercising his arms.
Very well, Doctor. What can I do for you?
Metz swam a slow kickstroke. He regarded Krydike amiably.
Captain, I believe it's time to rethink our strategy. Matters have changed since we came to Kithra.
Could you be specific?
Certainly. As you recall, we fled from the transfer point at Morgren because we didn't wish to be crushed in a seven-way ambush. You were quick to realize that even if we surrendered to one party, this would only result in all sides ganging up on our captors, inevitably leading to our destruction. I was slow to understand your logic. Now I applaud it. Of course, your tactical maneuvers were brilliant.
Thank you, Dr. Metz. You leave out another reason for our flight. We are under orders from the Terrigan's Council to bring our data directly to them, without leaks. Our capture would classify as a leak, wouldn't you say?
Certainly,
Metz agreed. And so the situation remained when we fled to Kithrop, a move which I now consider inspired. To my way of thinking, it was just bad luck this hiding place didn't work as planned. Krydike refrained from pointing out that they were still concealed in this hiding place.
Go on, he suggested. Well, the chance of escape is now next to nil. Kithrop remains a refuge from the chaos of battle, but it can't hide us for long once there is a final victor overhead.
You're suggesting?
I think we should consider our priorities and plan for unpleasant contingencies.
What priorities do you consider important? Krydike knew the answer to expect.
Why, the survival of this ship and crew, of course, and the data for evaluating the performance of both. After all, what was our main purpose out here,
Metz stopped swimming, regarding Krydike like a teacher quizzing a pupil. Krydike could list a half-dozen tasks that had been set for Streaker, from library veracity checks to establishing contact with potential allies, to Thomas Orley's military intelligence work. As Metz alluded, the primary purpose was to evaluate a Dolphin-crewed, Dolphin-commanded spacecraft. Streaker and her complement were the experiment. But everything had changed since they found the derelict fleet. He couldn't operate under the priorities he had been given at the beginning. How could he explain that to a man like Metz?
Judgment, Krydike mused. Thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason.
Sometimes he thought that the bard must have been half-dolphin himself.
I understand your point, Dr. Metz, but I don't see how it calls for a change in strategy. We still face destruction should we poke our beaks above Kithrop's sea.
Only if we do so before there's a winner overhead. Certainly, we shouldn't expose ourselves until the crossfire is over.
However, we are in a position to negotiate once there is a victor. We may yet win success for this mission.
Krydike resumed his slow spiral, forcing the geneticist to swim again toward the bridge lock.
Can you suggest what we might have to offer in negotiation, Dr. Metz?
Metz smiled.
For one thing, we have the information Brukita and Charles Dart have literally dug up. The institutes reward those who report ecological crimes. Most of the factions fighting over us are traditionalist conservatives of one stripe or another, and would appreciate our discovery.
Krydike refrained from expressing in raspberries his contempt for the man's naivete.
Go on, Doctor, he said levelly. What else have we to offer?
Well, Captain, there's also the honor of our mission. Even if our captors decided to hold on to Streaker for a while, they'd certainly be sympathetic to our purpose. Teaching clients to use spaceships is one of the basic tasks of Uplift. Surely they'd let us send a few men and Fenn home with our behavior evaluation data, so progress toward future Dolphin-crewed ships can continue. For them to do otherwise would be like a stranger interfering in the development of a child because of an argument with its parent. And how many human children were tortured and killed because of the sins of their parents back in your own dark ages? Krydike wanted to ask who would be the emissary to carry the Uplift data back to Earth while Streaker was held captive. Dr. Metz, I think you underestimate the fanaticism of those involved. But is there more? Of course, I saved the most important for last. Metz touched Krydike's flank for emphasis. We must consider giving the Galactics what they want. Krydike had expected it. You think we should give up the location of the derelict fleet? Yes. And whatever souvenirs or data we picked up there. Krydike wore his poker face. How much does he know about Jillian's Herbie, he wondered. Great dreamer, but that cadaver's caused problems.
This ends side one of cassette 4.